Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Ian, Thursday night on CNN was the much-promoted town hall event with President Obama and Anderson Cooper. A lot of folks who are very fond of the Second Amendment thought this would be nothing more than a shill for the administration's new executive actions and a call for more action and put more pressure on Congress. And certainly there was some of that, but it was much more even-handed than a lot of people on the right suspected. So kudos to Anderson Cooper and the people who participated, who brought in the other positions than the president was trying to espouse the other night, one of which was Taya Kyle. She, of course, is the widow of Chris Kyle, the American sniper. And she brought up a couple of good points. She gave a fairly lengthy lead into her question. And one of them, just almost as an aside, was a pretty good swipe at the Obama administration. For all their talk about stopping bad guys from getting guns, she dropped this little nugget on them.
Last I heard, the federal prosecution of gun crimes was like 40%. And what I mean by that is that there are people lying on these forms already, and we're not prosecuting them. So there's an issue there, right?
And then she talked about just the most basic argument, in addition to the fact that it's a constitutional right, about why people want the right to buy and carry weapons.
When you talk about the NRA and after a mass shooting, that gun sales go up, I would argue that it's not necessarily that I think somebody's going to come take my gun from me, but I want the hope, and the hope that I have the right to protect myself, that I don't end up to be one of these families, that I have the freedom to carry whatever weapon I feel I need, just like your wife said on that farm road. You know, the sheriffs aren't going to get to my house either. And I understand that background checks aren't necessarily going to stop me from getting a gun, but I also know that they wouldn't have stopped any of the people here in this room from killing. And so it seems like almost a false sense of hope. So why not celebrate where we are? I guess that's my real question is,
well,
celebrate that we're good people. 99.9% of us are never going to kill anyone.
She also pointed out that violent crime is at an all-time low, which she says corresponds to all-time high gun ownership. And the president says that's not necessarily connected in any way. So, Ian, good job by Taya Kyle here for not only pointing out the administration's hypocrisy on the issue, but also just explaining where I think millions and millions of American people are on this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always a healthy reminder to remember that the NRA is a lot closer to the sentiment of the American public than the president is on this, and the vast majority of the Democratic Party. Ms. Kyle brought up, as you said, several good points. There are a couple things worth addressing. The first is the specific claim that she pointed out about federal prosecution. So the president's executive action that's supposed to deal with the so-called gun show loophole, which of course doesn't exist, is sidestepping the central problem, which is that criminals, to the extent that we can track where they're getting their guns, are not getting them from gun shows or from online sales, which the president has also wrongly identified as a key source of weapons. They're getting them from straw purchasers. Well, there have been numerous reports of federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, deciding that they're not going to prosecute straw purchasers. Well, guess who has complete authority to hire and fire U.S. attorneys who don't do their jobs?
The president?
The president of the United States, right? So if the president wants to really address where a lot of criminals are getting their guns, all he needs to do is give a call to these U.S. attorney's offices and say, you need to start prosecuting these cases or I'm going to find someone who will. But he doesn't want to do that. Which brings me to the second point, that this is something that is sort of crystallized by this whole town hall event, as well-balanced as it ultimately was. The president, when he went out on stage to perform the other morning, is trying to sell these executive actions as sort of more or less sweeping, effective measures that are really going to bite into our crime problem, that he's, you know, this is what Congress won't do, so here's what I'm going to do. It's going to make a difference. It's going to make a big difference. And then he gets approached by someone like Ms. Kyle or some of the other people who had been victimized, who were invited to the town hall, and has to say, well, look, these aren't big sweeping measures. They're not going to radically, you know, change the law, et cetera. They're little pinprick, little scalpel things that we can do to tweak. Which is it? And ultimately, it's really more the latter. These are small things that really aren't going to make a difference in the overall level of gun crime, because they don't address the central problems but he has to put on this big show and performance, and that's what Miss Kyle is getting at the end when she says, "Look, you know, violent crime, at least murders, are down. You know, they're down enormously over the past 20 plus years. Why are we talking about this? Why don't people feel more safe?" Well, it's in part because the president has chosen to make this the drum that he's going to beat.
Let's stay with CNN for the bad martini now, and in a slightly related story, and that's the people trying to gather weapons and potentially kill us here, as well as helping terrorist organizations overseas. Here's the CNN story.
The six-page indictment unsealed tonight isn't detailed, but paints a picture of the suspect, Omar Faraj Saeed El-Hadan, a Palestinian born in Iraq, wanting to fight for ISIS, or as the government calls the terrorist group, ISIL. According to the three-count federal indictment, El-Hadan provided material support and resources to ISIL. When he applied to become an American citizen in 2014, he said he wasn't associated with a terrorist organization when, in fact, according to the indictment, he was throughout that year and the year before. And finally, during the citizenship process, he denied having weapons training when the government says he had been trained on an automatic machine gun. El-Hadan came to the U.S. as a refugee, 17 years old, in 2009.
And that's a critical factor as we debate what's going on with the refugees from Syria and elsewhere. Ian, so basically we're coming to the shocking conclusion here that sometimes refugees lie, and some of them are, in fact, involved in terrorist activities. And as this refugee debate plays out, this combined with the horrific activities we saw in Germany over New Year's and so forth, adding a lot more fuel to those who want to take a pause here.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of these refugees from conflict-ridden areas where terrorists are murdering people en masse might actually support those activities. Well, just, you know, bowl me over. This is a very important example because these are refugees who presumably at least went through that two-year-long meticulous vetting process that the administration has been going on about, that they proclaim is going to be applied with the same strictness to incoming Syrian refugees. One of these refugees came in 2009. One of them came in 2012, long before the Islamic State was a diabolical twinkle in anyone's eye. This is very serious. This is exactly what conservatives were worried about this are saying. These vetting procedures are not only often incapable of identifying people who are already involved, but there's the added problem of it's very, very difficult to tell who might become involved, who might 3 years, 5 years down the road say, you know, these folks over in Syria are doing really A-plus top-notch terroristic work, and I want to go join them. And we ought to add to that, One of these men who did go over, fight in Syria, returned to the United States and made it back without apparently tripping any wires at the Department of Homeland Security. So there's just a whole complex of problems that this indictment points out. It shouldn't be determinative about, you know, how we wrestle with this problem. You know, we ought to obviously always include the important qualifiers when we're talking about refugees and asylum seekers and the rest. But this raises serious concerns, and a responsible political culture must recognize that, or else you get something far more irresponsible, far more inflammatory, which is certainly where Europe is heading.
You're so xenophobic, Ian.
I know. Racist, xenophobic, Islamophobic, just it's the whole gamut.
Hitting for the cycle. All right, on to the crazy martini now. And poor Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee was his very successful governor of Arkansas, certainly electorally speaking, won multiple times there. He ran for president in 2008, won the Iowa caucuses, hung around for quite a while. I voted for him in Virginia because it was either him or John McCain. So, I mean, what are you going to do? And ultimately, of course, he didn't win the nomination. And then he had a very successful Fox show, decided to leave that to once again run for president. And it's just not happening for Mike Huckabee. He's not getting any traction in Iowa. It's obviously a very crowded field. There's a lot more evangelically friendly candidates in the field this time. Most of the people who are inclined to vote based on those values are seemingly headed towards Ted Cruz right now, and a lot of evangelical leaders are doing so as well. Todd Starnes of Fox News Radio asked Mike Huckabee about this, and here's Mike Huckabee's answer as to why the folks who were with him in 08 aren't with him now.
Do you feel a sense of betrayal from these folks?
Well, certainly a sense of disappointment, and yet, you know, I do understand because, as I've often said, I don't go to them, I come from them. But because of that, I do understand them. And a lot of them, quite frankly, I think are scared to death that if a guy like me got elected, I would actually do what I said I would do. And that is, I would focus on the personhood of every individual. We would abolish abortion based on the Fifth and 14th Amendment. We would ignore the Supreme Court same-sex marriage decision. And do you know what the result would be? A lot of these organizations wouldn't have the ability to do urgent fundraising, because if we slay the dragon, what dragon do they continue to fight?
So Mike Huckabee's contention here, Ian, is that because these evangelical leaders and pro-family organizations aren't endorsing him this time around, they're not really interested in the same goals they were and then they endorsed him in 2008. And it just appears that Mike Huckabee is not just burning bridges, he's dousing them with gasoline and then firebombing them.
Yes, for a minister, the word graceless comes to mind. I mean, the accusation that organizations that are against abortion really actually want abortion to be a problem so that they can still feel the rustle of donations in their pockets is not only shameful, but repulsive, despicable. Choose whichever other stronger adjectives come to mind. I mean, it's just astonishing. It's really disappointing that he would stoop to this. The fact of evangelical politics in previous election cycles, look at 2008, evangelicals came to Mike Huckabee in a much weaker field, and he lost. He didn't just lose the presidency, he lost the nomination. Perhaps these evangelical leaders, evangelical organizations are coming together and rallying behind candidates who they think might actually win, which seems to be the case with the fact that many of them, there was a meeting not too long ago in which many of them agreed that they would come together and support Ted Cruz. Instead of a diverse array of support for candidates who are long shots, they've come together and sort of are choosing to throw themselves uniformly behind one candidate in the idea that that candidate might actually win and they might actually get some of their policy goals enacted. What you ultimately sort of have to draw from Mike Huckabee's response, and he sort of hints at this later on in the interview with Starnes, is that the only decision for support that any evangelical could come to prayerfully is to support Mike Huckabee. That you know, you're not only betraying your cause, but you're betraying God if you support some other nominee besides the former Arkansas governor. It's very ugly. It's a very disappointing way for him to flame out.
He basically said later in the interview that if you believe in a God that can do great things, there's no reason not to support Mike Huckabee. if you're only relying on the wisdom of man at the moment, then you're going to go with someone else. So. Oh, Mike. Anyway, we'll see if a Fox show is waiting for him, or if maybe he'll guilt somebody into endorsing him here. I don't know. Ian, thanks for filling in for Jim. Have a great weekend. We'll talk
Absolutely.
To you later.
You too.
Ian Tuttle of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.